Chapter 4. Immolation. By the time fifth grade came around, fractures were beginning to form in my friendship with Natalie. She had a massive crush on this boy, Paul, who had mousy good looks and warm brown eyes. He did competition math. For a bit, we had been in the same advanced math classes together. "I'm going to do a perfume walk," she told me in the bathroom as she applied more lip gloss. "What's that?" I asked, impressed with her seductive abilities. She turned to me, pouting slightly. "You put on a bit of perfume, walk past the guy you have a crush on. If he turns and looks at you, then he has a crush on you." She did the perfume walk, but Paul didn't give her a single look. "I think he has a crush on you," she said, licking me up and down. For my birthday, she had gotten us matching Juicy Couture tracksuits. I had thought they were tacky. I hated rhinestones. But she had gotten it for me, and she said it looked good on me. After that, I started to develop a crush on Paul. If gorgeous Natalie, with all her feminine secrets gleaned from hours of poring over teen magazines, couldn't catch his interest, but I could, what did that say about me? I asked a different friend, Eliza, to watch the two of us one day during recess. I walked past him, no perfume. He followed me to the other section of the gymnasium. I walked past him again, and he followed me again. "He definitely likes you," Eliza said. Whenever he was my lab partner in science, I would wonder if he could feel the energy radiating off me. I thought he was so cute. I would meet his eyes in the hallway when we passed each other heading to class. My whole body felt charged, like a spring being coiled. Natalie and I sat beside each other in health class. The teacher showed us a diagram of different breast sizes and told us that in a few years we might have boobs this size. Natalie whispered to me, "Yours are already bees." The Broadway musical she was performing in went on tour. She was gone for 6 months. We would write each other letters, but I could feel that we were drifting apart. When she returned, she was cold towards me. I didn't know why. We used to always tickle each other as a greeting. One day, she snapped at me when I tried to tickle her. I could tell she was annoyed by me. She started hanging out with different girls, the ones who wore eyeliner and shimmering blush on their cheeks, who hiked up their skirts as high as the dress code would allow. I would look at old photos and miss her, wishing we could have another one of our sleepovers. Our friendship fell apart right before the school dance. We had already picked out our outfits for it. It was winter, so I was wearing an all-white ensemble, a white camisole with glittery lace, and a white miniskirt. I watched as she danced with her new friends. Paul's older brother came up to me, sprite in hand. He and Paul looked nearly identical, except that he had already gone through his growth spurt. "Hey," he said, with a cute lopsided smile, "you look good in white." I was flustered, but tried to play it cool. "Your fly is unzipped," I said, smirking, and watched him hide his attempts to zip it up. Around the time Natalie pushed me away, I was making new discoveries privately. My church arranged a massive youth retreat that was coordinated with several other fundamentalist churches in New York State. We all went to a massive camp in the Catskills in the middle of winter. The girls at my church were cliquish and hated me. There were five of them, all 1 year older, and they treated me like a little kid. I hated it. They would often offer condescending advice about sex and dating. One cornered me to lecture me about how gross kissing was. I was shocked. I asked her if she had ever kissed anyone. "No," she responded. "But imagine your saliva mixing with someone else's, their tongue in your mouth. Gross." I didn't tell her that I'd had my first kiss years ago and enjoyed it plenty. I often look back and wonder if they could tell I was queer. Not that I had a crush on anyone at my church specifically, but I think I didn't do a good enough job hiding it as I thought. Well, I know I didn't. One of the girls from a different church on the retreat was very beautiful, Melissa. I would sometimes stare at her without realizing, thinking she would never notice. But she did. One day, late at night, when the youth pastors had built a huge bonfire, she came and sat next to me, asked me whether I would roast her a marshmallow. Word had spread of my ability to get a marshmallow perfectly golden, totally mushy on the inside, without burning it. I let her pull the marshmallow off the stick and watch her eat it. Bits of gooey marshmallow still clung to her fingers, and she looked me in the eyes as she licked them. So good. I swallowed and looked back at the fire. It's hard for me to remember exactly what we talked about. Recounting yesterday's game of capture the flag, talking about what idiots the boys were, the cafeteria food, when all I could pay attention to was how close her leg was to mine, how she touched my arm when she laughed, how she rested her head on my shoulder as the fire started dying down, her hand on my thigh in the darkness. We walked back to the cabins together, hanging back from the main group, still talking. It was dark and eerie, the noises of wildlife in the background, the darkness punctured every now and then by streetlights spaced far apart. "Do you like me?" she asked, suddenly, her voice a little more serious. I knew she definitely didn't mean what I hoped she might mean, so I told her, "Of course." She held my hand, and we walked back together in silence. It's easy to forget, at that time, especially in my church, it was definitely not okay to be gay. Larger conversations were being had in society, and some of the kids who were at my school came out. They dealt with bullying, but nothing violent. My school prided itself on being progressive and diverse, featuring their Gay Straight Alliance Club prominently in the school yearbook. Some of my friends, the ones who knew I liked anime, would tease me for liking girls. "Everyone I know who likes anime is gay," said one of my guy friends. "Come on, you know it's true." I laughed him off. I didn't feel unsafe telling people at school in particular. If anything, it might have made me seem cooler. What I was worried about was anything getting back to my parents. People in my church were extremely homophobic. My parents, my mom especially, would rail against homosexuality as an awful sin. I heard whispers of people I knew being sent off to conversion therapy or one of those awful boarding schools out in the middle of nowhere where physical and emotional abuse were the daily norm. I was terrified that would happen to me. Melissa always found her way to me during free time at camp. It felt so strange to be pursued like this. It made my heart ache. One day, when we were walking to whatever activity was next, she asked me if I wanted to skip it. "Do you want to go for a hike instead? We could, like, pray together, or whatever." We laughed at the idea of us praying. We walked through the woods together, our breath making little puffy clouds in the cold air. Her puffy winter jacket was so cute. We were silent as we walked. I yearned for her. As we got further away from the camp, she stepped off the trail. I followed her. We wandered through the trees, and I tripped over a rock hidden under the snow. We got to a clearing, and she plopped on the ground, then started making a snow angel. "What about your pants?" I asked. "Won't they get wet?" I didn't want her to freeze. At the time, I was paranoid about death from hypothermia. She laughed, smirking, making intense and intentional eye contact with me. "They already are." I blushed at the implication. Seeing my flushed face, she stood up, walked to me, and kissed me. My lips were cold and chapped, and the heat of her breath and her lips felt so good. I couldn't hold myself back. I kissed her, putting my hands around her neck, pulling her in. It was like everything I had been holding back for years came rushing forth. I pressed myself against her, and we fell into the snow, our hats falling off. Hair covered in snow, I rolled on top of her, kissed her again, then pulled back, just looked into her eyes. I had tears welling in mine, and I went back for more. She wiggled, unzipping her coat, unzipping mine, and our hands were on each other's chest, grasping at softness. I kissed her neck. She moaned and put my breast in her mouth. I pressed my face into her neck, a tear making its way out of my eye, and I licked her ear, gently nibbled it. After much maneuvering, she pulled off her glove and stuck her hand down my pants, the chill of her fingertips pressing into me. We walked back to camp, our faces flushed. I don't think anyone missed us or noticed anything, but but I felt changed or marked in some way, like I was carrying a foreign object inside me, something under my skin. We went to that evening service, and I sang, closing my eyes, more tears trickling out of my eyes. Everyone thought me so pious. That year was the year that I could qualify to be an official member of the church. There was a special class we had to take, and whoever demonstrated the most thorough knowledge and understanding of the Bible would win a $25 gift card to the nearest Bible store. One boy in the class I hated with a passion, and he pompously declared that he had taken a similar class before, so of course he would be the one getting the gift card. So I had to beat him. I did, in fact, win the gift card. Not that it was terribly difficult, not that there was anything I wanted to purchase at that store. I gave the gift card to my mom, who loved daily devotionals. After the class, the pastor needed to interview you to make sure that you were someone the church could accept. When I went to the interview, I was terrified I wouldn't make it, that it would be so transparent that there was something wrong with me. The questions were all softballs, but I answered them like they were incredibly fraught. Afterwards, my mother told me that the pastor had told her that my hands were shaking. In sixth grade, I decided that I was going to try out for the school musical. Natalie was back in town, and of course she assumed, given her professional experience, that she was a shoo-in for the role. I went to auditions and tried to appear as confident as possible. I hadn't realized that we needed to prepare a song. I had assumed that everyone would be doing the same one. Most of the other girls had private voice lessons and had been spending months preparing their songs, as I later learned. The pianist whispered to me that he could play the Star Spangled Banner if I knew it. I agreed to the plan. I tried my best not to shake as I sang. The director started crying halfway through my song. Was I that bad? But then she clapped enthusiastically at the end, wiping tears out of her eyes. I told my mother proudly about my performance. Natalie and I both ended up getting minor roles. Everyone was mad because we were doing some obscure play. Because we were within a 50-mile radius of Broadway, we weren't allowed to put on any plays that had been put on in the past 3 years. Who the fuck thinks a middle school musical would be any competition with a fucking Broadway production? Natalie shouted at one of her friends, slamming her locker. Her mother made sure that Natalie's SAG affiliation was clearly displayed next to her name in the plays list of cast and crew. By eighth grade, I was an absolute wreck from carrying the pain of cluster headaches and the cognitive dissonance of my family's fundamentalist beliefs. I was unable to do schoolwork or even make it through most days without breaking down in tears. The conservative evangelical Christian belief system was really starting to get to me. What is justice? What are its aims? I just now Googled justice, and the first thing to pop up was a clothing brand for teen girls. As a child, the Constitution was discussed as if it was an extra book in the Bible, a sacred text to be upheld against all else. When I was older, my father even claimed that God had written it, using the founding fathers as his prophets. I like to imagine Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence as though responding to a Twitter flame war with the British Parliament, and the original Congress as a group chat. Somehow we've forgotten that the founding fathers were a bunch of drama queens, demanding duels to the death over ideological tiffs. Thomas Jefferson, the only Aries ever elected president. The etymology of justice splits in two directions, that of fairness, equity, exactly, snugly, and that of righteous in the eyes of God, legal rights, conforming to rules, authority. Some people are even endowed with the title of justice itself and given the power in court to declare what may be right and fair. The word just itself has transformed from meaning exactly or precisely to almost, merely, or barely. One must think of how our concept of justice may have shifted as well. The Etymology Online entry on justice refers back to Federalist Paper number 51. If the Constitution is equivalent to the Word of God, then the Federalist Papers are considered the letters from Paul written to the churches, the proper lens from which to interpret the intent of the author. The 51st paper was of great importance to me as a child, that James Madison text I love so much. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and then in the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control in the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. The end of the quote makes clear the intent of the founders. The intent of the government to control the governed and to control itself. How utterly puritanical! This quote lays bare so much of the very American obsessive-compulsive behavior. Our need for rules to govern every situation, dictating the best way to behave, and a need for signs everywhere to remind everyone of the rules. Control, control, control. I have been spending so much of my time lately reading the subreddits, Am I the Asshole? And Relationship Advice. Often my favorite posts there are discussing HOAs or housing associations. Most common in suburbs where people are rule-obsessed in the extreme. They often dictate how you must keep your lawn, acceptable colors to paint your house, acceptable lawn ornaments, noise levels, etc. There are so many rules that it becomes quite impossible to abide by all of them without living a life so bland it could barely be called a life. Of course, these rules are never enforced with an even hand, at least in the Reddit posts. Some small-time, maniacal psychopath manipulates their way to the top of the HOA leadership, mostly because no one else has the desire or energy to stop them. From their meager throne as president of the housing association, they find neighbors they detest and are lenient towards those who act as their toadies. HOAs were originally formed to collect small fees from the neighborhood to provide general upkeep, to make sure the roads and sidewalks are maintained, perhaps have a public playground or pool. People are bizarre and strange creatures, lusting after power and fairness in the same breath. I like a particular study that tested people's ability to accurately perceive the force with which they were hit. A mechanical arm would lightly punch someone, and people were asked to reproduce the force of the hit on a pad that would record their force. The results were unsurprising. People hit the pad with far more force than they were hit. In a fight, this leads to an eternal escalation of blows, each insisting that they were only hitting back with the same force. How ghoulish and strange, yet wonderful we are. Finding that balance between advocating for ourselves and advocating for others is near impossible. Of course, anyone with power is likely to abuse it. Power does not corrupt. We were already there. Of course, I am an optimist, believing we as humanity are slowly developing our empathy. This bullying and brutish behavior is unsustainable at this point in our existence. We need balance. My grandmother moved in with us after being diagnosed with breast cancer for the second time. The first time, I had been too young to remember. She had recovered. The second time, she was much older. She brought with her piles of books. I would sit in her room with her and read them. She read very widely. My favorite books of hers were Amy Tan. She taught me to crochet. She grew sicker and sicker. She lost all of her fat and her skin hung off her bones. It was so painful to see her like this, so frail. She held onto the walls as she walked, rejecting my parents' attempts to get her to lean on them until she couldn't. Her arms were still covered in the gold bangles she always wore. Her hands would shake as she held mine, as she taught me about something. My mother was always happy to see us together. Her health steadily declined over the year. She was in so much pain. As her health and her breath grew especially precarious, her best friend from Florida flew up to be with her. My grandmother asked my mom and me to go on a walk while she talked to her. When we came back, she was dead. Her friend was wiping tears from her eyes. She just wanted to say goodbye one last time, she said. I told her it was okay to go. It was okay to leave. She could be at rest. She closed her eyes and died in peace. I cried in bed that night and again after her funeral. I wasn't necessarily sad she had died. I missed her. But it seemed like it was her time to go. My mother knew my grandmother and I had had a special relationship. She always wanted one of the grandchildren to have her blue eyes, she said. You were the only one. Natalie quit Girl Scouts, and I grew closer to the other girls in the troop. One girl in particular I'd admired since we had been in the same kindergarten class, Ava. She was so brilliant. In addition to Girl Scouts, we also participated in Science Olympiad competitions together. For the longest time, she had thought I was really annoying, and when our coach paired us together to take on the plate tectonics portion of the competition, she rolled her eyes and sighed. But I slowly won her over, proving that even though I was weird and didn't put any effort into most of my regular classes, I could be incredibly focused when I wanted to be. We would have sleepovers together, studying, attend lectures, and practice questions until we knew we were ready. We ended up winning a gold medal together, and she started to like me. She started sharing her writing with me, both poetry and little short stories. I would read them for her and suggest edits. She made me a mixtape with a bunch of indie rock, and I started enjoying listening to music for the first time. She and I and a few other girls started having sleepovers together, ostensibly to watch movies, but it quickly morphed into a writing group. We would all share our poetry, plays, and drafts of novels with each other, offer critique, collaborate with each other. We would stay up late and talk about philosophy, politics, art. The sleepovers were usually at Ava's house, at least at first. Her late father was an architect who designed the home himself. It was beautiful and a little strange. I would walk through the hallways, admiring their art collection. Of course, I had a crush on Ava, and sometimes I felt like she had a crush on me too. I remember having dinner with her and a few other friends. Towards the end, we were tired and leaning on each other, our hands resting together, her thumb slowly caressing my palm. One of the other girls looked over, stared for a few moments at her thumb rubbing me, then looked away. One year, she was off at a writing camp and called me, distressed, telling me that one of the girls had confessed a crush, that she didn't know what to do. She said she didn't understand why everyone thought she was a lesbian. Internally, I was crushed, but I swallowed it and said that if the girl was a good friend, she would understand if the crush was unreciprocated. Moving to high school, like the transition to middle school, radically changed my friendships. I was already cynical. I'd watched the way my friendship with Natalie had ended, and I knew that some of my other relationships wouldn't last. Ava went off to a different school than I did, but we swore that we would keep in touch for the rest of our lives, and at the time, I believed it would be true. I went to a school that had a specialized arts program, and I told the rest of the Girl Scout troop that I doubted we would be friends for much longer. I thought that the group would splinter and that most of us would end up drifting apart. I was shocked that the other girls were upset by this. One girl, who I had always thought hated me, who would often make snide or condescending remarks about me, was especially upset. She told me it was important that we remain friends, no matter what happened. Of course, we drifted apart. I didn't really value those friendships and honestly had only ever engaged because it felt like I needed to survive, to avoid my teachers complaining to my parents about my lack of friends. I instead grew closer to the people in the art program who seemed to not just tolerate my strange ways, but celebrate them. I didn't get my period until relatively late when I was 16. When it came to learning about tampons, I had to turn to the internet. My mother was terrified of sex. She wouldn't ever mention it, nor anything related to the genitals, not even in a non-sexual way. Health class wasn't much help either. I think it's common for people to say that children shouldn't learn about sex from the internet, but for me it turned out to be my saving grace. I joined a variety of internet forums, some about psychology, others about technology. If I hadn't been able to learn about sex on the internet, I would have had a very warped view of my body. The cool thing about these message boards was that, while they did discuss the topic of interest, there were always separate boards where active members would discuss their personal lives. One of the boards I was a part of was frequented by a dominatrix who lived in San Francisco. She and her husband had an open relationship, and she was quite knowledgeable about sexual health. I am still grateful that I was able to have her as a resource when I was so young. Communities like old internet forums were so different from the social media popular now. For one, there were so many of them. They usually centered around a specific topic of interest, so the number of people involved was naturally more limited. I think this humanized the relationships people had. It was more like a small town or village, where people might have feuds or flame wars, but always on a smaller scale. My father was still indoctrinating me with constant lectures of conservatism to prevent the secular children of my school and whatever I was reading online from corrupting me. Mark Levin was my favorite of the talk radio hosts. He was snide, sarcastic, analytical, and approached all his arguments with an academic lilt. He referenced the Constitution in the same manner my pastor referenced the Bible. I would download every episode onto my iPod player and listen to him every morning as I walked to school and hung outside my locker, waiting for homeroom. Rush Limbaugh, the most popular of the talk show hosts, was too bombastic and always sounded like an idiot to me. I could never listen to him. My father told me that he thought I had the makings of an excellent politician. I could never run, though I wish I could, he said. I have too many skeletons in my closet. He never told me what those skeletons were. I remember going to one of the first Tea Party protests with my father. One ugly old white man was carrying around a racist sign with Obama's face on it in vaguely tribal makeup. The sign said, "Some village has lost its idiot." My father went up to him and told him to put it away. "That sort of thing makes us all look bad," he said. Seeing my inability to focus on school as ADHD instead of the massive existential crisis that it was, my doctor referred me to a psychiatrist who recommended that I start a high dose of Ritalin. Ritalin made my insomnia and all other issues worse. Once, on my way to school, I heard someone calling my name. I turned and there was no one. After I said I had begun hearing voices, the psychiatrist told my mother he thought I had schizophrenia, and that he wanted to put me under observation at a special center for a month. She took me to a different doctor who instead said I was bipolar and started me on lithium. The specter of going mad would always drive me more crazy than I actually was. My father's mother died around the time I was starting to see psychiatrists. Her funeral was strange. I had never really known her. I got to meet all the aunts and uncles my father had pushed away. One was an aunt working at the Fed as an analyst, complaining that everyone had always assumed she was a lesbian, even though it was her brother who was gay. I was so excited to meet my uncle and his boyfriend, who I had heard so much about. I was glad there was another queer person in the family. At a barbecue after the funeral, one of my grandma's cousins remarked that there was always a crazy one in every generation of the family. Everyone looked at me as though I was next. My father told me that I reminded him of his mother. She used to paint lighthouses obsessively. Her paintings looked like she had learned to paint from one of those books sold for $1.99 at the craft store. Apparently, she drove to paint real lighthouses, but they always looked like a cylinder, shaded like a computer-generated image. There was seagrass and sand, the sand flat, the seagrass made by scraping paint in a Bob Ross fashion. For so long, I looked down on this style of painting. I found it plebeian. My father said that she was an incredible painter, and I never corrected him. My own art teachers in high school thought little of me until my senior year. I skipped class and would hang out in the studio, painting and painting and painting. I was incredibly suicidal, pained and overwhelmed, and painting was a way for me to take all that was whirling inside me and put it somewhere else. My art teacher looked at one of my paintings and said with surprise, "When did you get so good?" I rolled my eyes at that one. I submitted my favorite pieces to the regional art fair and won a lot of awards, including first place for non-portrait art. I was annoyed again, as what I had painted was a portrait, just not painted in a particularly traditional fashion. I felt misunderstood. My ex-boyfriend won first place in portrait art with a self-portrait. I think there is a certain ease in letting yourself believe that you are actually insane. If nothing you know is real, then whatever action you take is inconsequential because you're delusional. What does it matter? The interesting thing about lithium is that it also treats cluster headaches. I worshipped the drug for stopping the pain. And then I started to believe that my headaches were not in fact headaches, but bipolar episodes. The lithium, however, did not treat my existential anxieties. I did stop wanting to kill myself, but still wouldn't deign to complete my homework, preferring to learn by instead reading books or browsing theory online. One of my favorite books in high school was ominously titled Being No One. Thomas Metzinger, the author, theorized that the self and consciousness is just an illusion, something which evolved as a byproduct of our evolutionary drive. A pattern can more effectively defend itself if it has a sense of its own existence in the first place. It is interesting to think of memes as having a sort of consciousness of their own. Of course, we refer to them as viral, their contagion being something which can harm or help, depending on your perspective. I think of the ancient virus, which gave us the genetic code for the cord which binds fetus to mother in the womb, and of COVID-19, which has killed so many. The word meme has been mostly reduced to an internet term, but of course, there are older memes, often religious. As we once gathered in temples of worship to have our reality dictated to us, now we worship at our phones, where new religions are built every day. The burning pitchforks and crusades of religious fervor are strategically, geographically isolated, while digital flame wars are ensconced in our phones. Religion is usually about controlling the reproductive power of women. One day, all of the girls from church were gathered together for a weekend sleepover. We were told we were like delicate porcelain teacups, and we should have men treat us as such. Do you want to be like a coffee mug? Unappreciated, thrown out without a care if you break? Or do you want to be like a teacup, rimmed in gold, placed in a special cabinet and taken out with care for special occasions? Worst of all was the disposable coffee cup, styrofoam and toxic. Heaven forbid we should ever be like that, to be used once and thrown in the trash. As a child, I was intrigued by the metaphor. Endless styrofoam coffee cups at all the coffee shops, used once and then tossed. It does sound quite a bit like the lurid tales spun by sex trafficking organizations, painting tragic tales of millions of exploited women. Perhaps while I'm at work, I am like a very nice teacup in a fine dining restaurant, used by many, but handled for the most part with care. I certainly have no aspirations to be kept in a cabinet somewhere, gathering dust.